So how did we meet? Or Mike is asking how we met.
Yep. We've known each other a while.
Yeah.
I think
we're about the same age.
Very close in age. Mm. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. No, Daniel's quite a bit younger than I am.
So actually our dads both met each other first.
Okay.
So the Brookfield group has been doing IT and things like that for Acessa for, I don't know, 15 years now.
Oh, at least.
Over 15, I think.
Maybe pushing 20.
Almost 20, yeah.
Yeah.
So I probably met Vince, I think, when I was in high school working for the Brookfield group. So known him a while from
that doesn't make me feel old at all.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And then, so now I run the Brookfield group, and then Vince keeps me busy with lots of ideas and things to do. And then we both play golf. So
yeah, thank you for that. So,
that helps.
That was nice.
That helps us. You know, we do a lot of golf work meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely get a lot done that way.
Business development.
Mm-hmm. Business development.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. 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 No problem.
All right. So if you need any IT related questions.
He's the man.
Yeah. He's the man.
Good to go, Daniel. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem.
Is this thing on?
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Summits Podcast. Thank you all for joining us from wherever you get your podcasts. For those of you joining us on the Heroes Foundation YouTube channel, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you. Don't forget, hit that subscribe button, hit the notification bell so you can be alerted when new episodes like this one drop. We would appreciate it. Won't cost you a dime. All right, folks. Big guest today, Mike and Jamie Simic.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Perfect.
Good.
Welcome to the Summits Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Why don't you guys give us a little intro?
Sure. Well, first I want to say thank you first for giving us the opportunity to come say hello to you. Vince, thanks for, you know, introducing yourself. We spent a lot of time with you before the podcast and telling us about your story and about this organization. And so hats off to you guys, the great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
A pleasure to be here with you this morning. So thanks for that.
Likewise.
So we were talking earlier, right? So you said introduce yourself. I'm from Michigan. My bride here is from Indiana and, you know, spent my years in Southeast Michigan, grew up with the college, graduated college, and then went to the Marine Corps. So since, you know, spent 25 years in the Marine Corps active and reserve, deployed to Afghanistan for a time, which will come back into this story, I think, a little bit. And when I was up at Purdue University, right, when I was recruiting Marine officer candidates, I ran into this young lady who was getting her graduate degree at Purdue, and I was supposed to be recruiting for the Marine Corps. And I was recruiting for my corps.
I was just going to interject with that, but you beat me to it.
She was not qualified to be a Marine officer, right? We had to disqualify her right from the outset. So we got married, went back to, interject a little bit into that. So 2001, right before 9/11, in fact, and my mom, who I was very close with, got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Okay. And she was 52, I think, at the time. Okay. And her father, my grandfather, also had pancreatic cancer and died at 52. So that was a shock to the system. And it was, you know, it's right at the point of whether or not I was going to stay in the Marine Corps, make it a career or transition. So that was kind of what helped us make the transition out of the Marine Corps. And they were great to me, by the way, let me go early, let me go back to Michigan, spend time with my mom, help be a caregiver for, you know, she needed a lot of help. Mm-hmm. And then she passed away in 2001, late 2001. So I was off active duty for a while. And then Jamie and I got married in 2002, spent a number of years in Michigan, and, you know, gals want to go back where they're from. So we decided in 2008 to come back here to Indiana. We've lived here ever since, and it's been great. Love it. Love Indiana. When we were living in Michigan, when you go back to home, it never really was quite home like it is here, right? Being by Jamie's family and being close to friends. We've lived there for 15 years. Our kid, our two kids, Kate, who's at Purdue right now, freshman at Purdue. She was 3 years old, and Tyler, our son, was 3 months old when we left. And poor guy, you know, I don't know how this happened, but he came a Lions fan, right? I'm like, son, you don't need to be a Lions fan. You could become a Colts fan. And we had a great year this year. But
I'd say, yeah, it was a good year this year.
It was a good year, but many years has been mediocrity. But we're also Michigan football fans, so he's got that going for us.
So it's good. It's been a good year.
Yeah. We were at the national title game, so it was been a great year. And, you know, part of, you know, getting diagnosed with cancer, you're like, all right, life is short. We're going to enjoy a lot of this life. So, we took advantage of that and had a good time. So what else can you add?
I mean, pretty well covered it, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Jamie, you said you're from Indiana originally. Whereabouts?
So my family is from Rockville.
Okay.
Covered Bridge Festival.
Yeah.
Just straight right. west of Indianapolis. So, yep. I went to high school in Rockville. Went to Purdue. Okay. My bachelor's and master's degrees are from there. And I've actually never not worked for nonprofits since. So.
Okay.
So, yeah. We've had a good run in a couple different places and I've love our community here in Indianapolis, like Mike said, and mm-hmm. they've been amazing. Kind of how we were talking before, just
right.
to have those people surrounding mm-hmm. you. So, yeah.
Okay, cool. Pancreatic cancer relative to your mom and your grandfather.
Sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Still one of the tough ones mm-hmm. out there.
Very much so.
Typically, I'm not a physician, so don't mm-hmm. at me. You can comment all
Ask
you want
here starting now.
Right. But it tends to be one of those that you don't discover, don't start seeing symptoms until it's metastasized or it's progressed far
right.
enough along.
That's right.
I know that just through some random readings that there are a variety of projects focused on pancreatic right now because it is so lethal. Mm-hmm. One of which, and there may be multiple, but one of which I know is trying to detect it earlier just via a blood test, yep. as simple as that, which mm-hmm. would be phenomenal for all cancers.
Yeah.
I think there are some that are making some pretty significant progress there. That would be huge, especially for a cancer type like that. So, you know, knock on wood, they can continue down that path and hopefully we can help them yeah. with that. But yeah. that would be good. So what was the next step? I mean, you said you moved to Indianapolis or Indiana in 08. Then where things progressed from there?
Yeah.
Where were you working at the time?
So I've spent most of my adult career in kind of the defense industry. So I was working okay. with Kelly, right?
Sure.
Our good friend, Kelly
right.
Canada, who is, I think, your volunteer, right, of
yeah,
the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Year. So she and I worked together.
So were you with Rolls-Royce then?
I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's see. So I got off active duty in 2001, which was right before 9/11, literally like a month after.
Right.
A month before. And strange time. So fast forward 2.5, 3 years, we're in Michigan. It's 2004. I feel like an able-bodied person.
I do have one quick question.
Sure.
I did not ever serve. My father did for 20-plus years in the
yeah.
Navy, so I'm somewhat attached to it. But I have a question. You may have been asked this before. When you got out and then you said 9/11 happened, did it made you think about maybe going back in or no?
100%.
Yeah.
So it was August of 2001. I got off active duty and then 9/11 happened.
Oh, wow.
So it was
quick.
Literally there.
Yeah.
Well, if he hadn't gotten off then,
yeah.
then we probably, I mean, he would have been stopgapped. Probably he wouldn't have even been able to leave after that. And so, like, the whole course of our lives would have changed because
yeah.
by the time he would have been able to think about getting out, then we would have been so far into it, it would have been like, well, we should just,
right.
you know, get the 20 years active
100%.
And finish
you know, one month later, we would have spent the rest of my life in the Marine Corps. But
yeah.
as fate would have it, it didn't happen like that. Answer your question. So fast forward to 2004, country's at war, and you know we had discussed this. I'm like, well, I really feel like I need to make a contribution.
Yeah.
So at that point in time,
were you doing reserves at that point? Or
no, I wasn't. I was okay. inactive, ready reserve.
Okay.
Still had a commission, and then through my, you know, basically got back in as a reservist, and then
okay.
spent and loved it. By the way, it was fantastic. You know, love the Marine Corps, love our nation,
mm-hmm.
love the young Marines that serve, and our daughter's training to be a Marine officer candidate.
Oh, cool.
So
nice.
It just seemed like the right thing to do, okay. And so I got back in the reserves and would have bet a paycheck when I was an active duty Marine working up at Purdue. The reserves were not the same back then. Post 9/11, they became operational. So I never thought I would join the reserves. I did, and I loved it. It was fantastic. And then from 2000,
for those of us non-military, what does that yeah. mean exactly?
Yeah.
When so they became operational?
Yeah. So great question. So when they're pre 9/11, they weren't. The reserves weren't deploying in support of combat operations. They
okay.
were doing their 2 weeks a week, 2 weeks a year, mm-hmm. 1 week at a month, and that was their thing.
Yep.
Post 9/11, they were operational. Reserves were getting deployed. In fact, I was a company commander up in South Bend.
Okay.
I had Marines that deployed 3-4 times Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was back
okay.
to back to back to back. So
gotcha.
Those guys. So in terms of, you know, proficiency, tactical proficiency, reserves are probably because you're not doing it every day, right? You're not as proficient as an active duty Marine. That went by the wayside post 9/11 because they were operational.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, long story short, 2004, we decided to get back in and 20 years later, 20 years in the reserve. So 25 approximately years
okay.
serving. And it was great. It was great because we could do plant the seeds here in Indiana and still serve with pride and do some different things. So, yeah. But then I deployed to Afghanistan in 2011, 2012. And, you know, at that point in time, I was an old guy, right? So the Marine Corps is a very young fighting force. Most of Marines, I think 70%, are first-termers. So, you know, four years are in. So at that point in time, I think I was 38, 39 when I deployed. I was an old guy. I mean, the average age of a Marine is 20, low 21 20s. Years old. So I'm twice as old. I still felt young, but I wasn't young. I was an old guy. You know, as you become older, you become hopefully wiser. And war is not glorious. War is not good. And my goal was to go accomplish the mission and bring everyone back safely. So we were in combat operations, although we didn't see combat. So the Marines were disappointed. You know, they all want to get a combat action ribbon. They're yielding. They're ready for a good fight. And it didn't happen. And I was grateful, right? So we had a mission to go build patrol bases and no significant action. They were disappointed. I was delighted because we brought back 150 Marines with 10 fingers, 10 toes.
Right.
Didn't have to write any letters to moms or wives. It was a blessing. So we got back in 2012 and you kind of reassimilate back into civilian life. Now, here's an interesting story. At that time, my dad got diagnosed with cancer. So he had got diagnosed with prostate cancer before I left, and he was terminal. Kind of said goodbye to him before I left. Is that kind of how it...
He was, I mean, they didn't, he was ill, but not.
Yeah, that's right.
Not, quote unquote, dying. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. He, thank you. He had been diagnosed, went to Afghanistan, and then, you know, the Red Cross helps in instances like this where they sent a Red Cross signal that my dad was, Jamie had found out that he was deemed to be terminal at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, they ask for you to come back. And as a commander, right, I was a company commander, you don't want to leave your troops in battle, right? They're there. So there was definitely a moral dilemma that I had. But ultimately, I had a great team and felt like it was the right thing to do to come back. And it was really strange because you go from being in a, my dad was at Florida at the time. My little sister was down in Florida and went from being in a combat zone, not in combat. There's different things, right? A combat zone where you're on your guard all the time, right? Even at Camp Leatherneck, because you know, Camp Leatherneck was filled with civilians, and you never know who the good guys are or the bad guys. That's the reality of what it was. So you're always on your guard. And then you come back, and Jamie and the kids were down in Florida. My little sister was down in Florida. She flew in.
It was weird.
It was weird.
I mean, it was weird because he had been gone, and then. I mean, I literally had to call the Red Cross and be like, hey, I need you to get a hold of my husband. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that was a Wednesday and we met him in Florida on a Friday, to go see his dad. I hadn't seen him. The kids were like 6 and 3. Mm-hmm. And so there, all of a sudden, here we are picking him up at the airport, thinking we weren't supposed to see him until like February or March. Mm-hmm. And this is October. And
you feel like, you know, I felt like I was cheating because all my Marines are there. They can't see their families. And I'm going home to see my family. So then it was October. It was Halloween. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, you know, being in the combat zone one day and the next day. We're in this area in Florida, and it just didn't feel safe. I just didn't feel safe.
We were at a trunk or treat.
Trunk or treat.
And we were all on the street, and all these people had backed up, and there was still traffic on the street, and there were kids, and he was just, you know, he's like, we got to get out of here.
We got to go.
We got to get out of here. Yeah. And, just, you know, and his... I think when you've been around that lifestyle for a while and you've gone through all the briefings, and I was fortunate because at that time I was actually working in veteran services. So I was getting to work with veterans every day. Mm-hmm. And he's like, we got to get out of here. And I was like, okay, you're right. Let's go. Mm. It's fine. And so, you know, the kids got plenty of candy. They were fine. they didn't miss out on their trick or treating.
They did not miss out at all.
But yeah, it was a weird thing for him to come back and literally have to get his dad's affairs in order.
I did.
For a week. And then we dropped him back off at the airport. And so he flew back to Afghanistan.
Older brother and a younger sister, God bless them both, but I was run taking care of everything, right? So come back from that and making sure you know, my dad, my mom had passed away, so my dad had been remarried since. So I had to like make everything fit and everyone's different emotions with that. It was complicated. It was a challenge. And then to go, you know, say goodbye to him, go back. go back to Afghanistan. That was tough because that was the last time I'd seen him. So
right, yeah. Mm-hmm. How long were you in Afghanistan in total?
7 months. Okay. Activated for a year, so they activated us about 3 months before. Went to Camp Lejeune, went to Afghanistan, then came back and was gone from the family for about a year. You know,
you guys were at 29 Palms for
29
a while.
Yeah.
Jimmy, how did that go? I don't want to make an assumption, but.
Well, you know, it was. I think you kind of just knew it was going to happen, right? I mean, by that point, it was 10 years, you know, mm-hmm. after 9/11. And I mean, it was, I don't want to say it was time for him to go, but it was time for him to go do what he had signed up to do. Mm-hmm. And he got a great opportunity to lead an amazing company. He brought together Marines from like 7 different states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then they joined an active duty battalion, which was interesting. So they were their reserve unit with all these other active duty Marines. And there were guys he'd never met before. And all of a sudden, you know, you got to pull it together. And so
you're managing both of those groups coming together.
It was, you know,
it's probably a whole separate podcast.
When you think about, like, you reflect on your professional accomplishments, I mean, by far, that is the thing I'm most proud of, is bringing those Marines together from all these different sites that didn't know, getting them ready, you know, 150 Marines, 13 different sites, 8 different states, and forge that into a fighting force and go into Afghanistan. That, you know, great staff, you know, the best Marine man I love dearly to this day, Manuel Gonzalez, you know, he was the guy that kind of helped forge things. But that right there, that was kind of the pinnacle, the thing I'm most proud of bringing that group together, getting them into Afghanistan, and getting them back home safely and accomplishing the mission.
Right.
Yeah.
I would say from us being at home, I mean, again, it was kind of that same support system that we are relying on now in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. We were fortunate. I mean, thank God we were in Indiana. My parents were close. My grandmother was taking care of us. You know, we had neighbors who were fighting over who was going to mow our lawn, and the church had set up like a like the meals. They would bring us a meal every Monday that the kid, which was just so, like, I just looked forward to Monday every day. All right, you know, it was great. And so, and it was, we actually, because it was so much later in the conflict. Mm. I mean, we got to be in communication pretty well. Mm-hmm. It was weird stuff, like the fact that I think Afghanistan is, what, like 8.5 hours ahead or something crazy. Yeah. So like this time difference, if I didn't get an email to him before I went to bed, he wouldn't have an email to read when he woke up in the morning.
About that,
like, it was those kind of things that were.
They had troops in World War II who, like, sent a letter, and then 8 weeks later they get one back from their wife. Yeah. And I'm getting it. If I don't get an email in the morning, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it was a very surreal kind of time. And I mean, even now, like, because they came back in the middle of February. So that memory pops up in my Facebook of like the homecoming festivities and everything. And every year I'm like, man, that feels like yesterday and 100 years ago all at the same time. So it's good. But like I said, at the time, I mean, I was working with veterans. I was working with people who were military connected. So had a great, great support system there. And and everybody came back, and we had some babies that were born in the company while the guys were gone. But for the most part, you know, it was a happy return. So,
but life is short, right? And
absolutely.
So you have conversations like we've had since my diagnosis, right? About, okay, we're going to go to Afghanistan, and there's a decent chance, or not a decent chance, but there's a possibility you're not going to come back. So you start having these conversations, these very pragmatic, but emotional conversations about, all right, here's how I want you to raise my kids. Here's what I want you to do if I'm not around. So, you know, having an appreciation for how short life is, and knowing that every day is precious is important, and comes into play here as you fight, as you go, you know, fight through cancer too. Right.
Yeah. Well, so, good segue, Mike. Yeah. What is your cancer story?
Well, like I told you, my mom and my grandfather both had pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
Died at 52. So I'm almost 50. Father died when he was 64. So I've always known that I was going to get cancer. I knew it. And you know, so when it happened, I was surprised that it came that early. I'm like, you know, I always used to say, kind of in a joking manner, any day past 52 is like icing on the cake. And I definitely want to live past 52, and I'm going to But I knew it was going to come, right? But I think you talked about some of the priorities of your organization, just being aware, right? And I was at a higher risk level, so for a host of reasons. One, because of my my family history, and certainly my genetic mismatch, my genetic deficiencies that I've got, but also being in a combat zone and knowing this, and knowing that I had friends, really good friends, that had some GI cancer, right? And so a smarter man than me, a more wise person than I would have been taking more proactive measures, and I wasn't. So,
or one that was listening to his wife about getting his colonoscopy.
Yeah. So you know, maybe a little bit of ignorance and arrogance mix, which is a dangerous mix, right? So what I should have been doing was getting a colonoscopy at age 45, because I know that for a lot of reasons, you're getting that diagnosis a lot earlier than you did in the past. And I was at a higher risk level. And we know, Jamie found a stat today about the number of veterans that are, we know, what did it, was it 100 times more likely to die from cancer than they are to die in combat. Mm-hmm. So yeah, okay. I should have known. Okay.
That might be a separate episode itself.
I should have known this was coming. Well, I did know it was coming, but you just get so busy in life and all the things that you're doing, right? Raising kids. And
I think sometimes men too, and not to be sexist, but I mean, when I turned 45, my doctor was like, hey, it's time to go get your colonoscopy.
Yeah.
And you know, he was 48. You were 49 when you were diagnosed. I mean, and I kept saying, come on, I have to go get a colonoscopy and you don't. Like, I feel like you probably should get this done.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes...
That's for when you turn 45, right?
When you turn 45, yeah. Happy birthday.
More, 10 more years to go, right? Or something like that?
Yeah. Right.
But, yeah. And so I think that, you know, part of... If we can inspire 1, 2, 10, 100 people to be like, oh, yeah, okay, I don't want to get a... Nobody wants to go get their colonoscopy. Right. Mm-hmm. Go get it, because, you know, it used to be 50 and now it's 45. Yeah. And that's because, you know, there is a younger onset, especially of colon cancer that they're seeing right now, that doctors can't really explain. Right. And so that, you know, it's one of those cancers that you can stop its progression, because if they go in and they find something they can remove.
Right.
Then it's not cancer. But if you wait.
So for the youngsters here who haven't had the experience yet,
right?
I'm telling you right now, as much as you probably don't want to, it's not a big deal.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah. The prep's not fun, whatever, thing, but that's the procedure itself.
Well, our last guest, their foundation is all about, you know, checking, like getting your colonoscopy and checking early.
Yeah.
And I mean,
check it for Andretti.
Yeah. Check it for Andretti. Jared's he's the same age as me, right? 33.
Some pretty close.
Right around there. Yeah. So I know he's got his done. So there's no reason not to. And that's me talking to myself too. So,
well, and there I was, right? There's no reason not to. And it wasn't, I don't know what it was. Laziness. I have no idea. I have no explanation. Denial. Maybe I was just too busy. I don't think it was denial though. Okay. I don't know what it was. So anyways, you know, my daughter Kate's graduating and life is busy and we're going 100 miles an hour like you do in life. And, you know, start to see some symptoms. Ignore the symptoms. Symptoms are going to go away. They're going to go away. I'm not going to worry about. I can't worry about this right now because I got more important things in my life going on. We got Kate's graduation party, and maybe then I was in denial, because you kind of hope and wish that, you know, the symptoms go away. I'm like, God, this is not a big deal. Just kind of pushed it off, and we talked about it a little bit.
You mind if we talk about what the symptom is? Is that? I mean, I know it's not.
Sure.
I mean, because I think that's one of the questions that. I don't know if people ask you, but they ask me all the time, well, how did he know? Did they just find it during a colonoscopy? And some people do find it. I mean, and nobody wants to talk about like rectal bleeding. Like that's not a cool thing to talk about in mixed company, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think it's one of those things that if it happens, you're shocked.
Yeah.
And you're like trying to just,
On
justify, the one hand, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm dying of cancer. And on the other hand, oh, you know what? Yep. Maybe I just need to get the aloe toilet paper. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but it wasn't. Yeah, you're exactly right. It's good to talk about it. I wasn't because it's an uncomfortable thing to talk about. But yes, it was there. And it wasn't like a little bit. It was a lot. And I remember talking to you about it. Like, you know, there's blood in my stool, you know, and just something I was watching, hoping it goes away. And it wasn't. But again, life was too busy. I don't know how many weeks went by, 4 or 5 weeks. Too many weeks. Too many weeks. And then. You know, I've worked with a VA. The VA sometimes gets a bad reputation. My experience with this VA in Indianapolis has been outstanding. They've been great. They've just I do everything through them. Jamie and the kids go through somewhere else, but they've taken care of me. So one day, you know, I'm just like, all right, you know, it happened again. I call up the VA and they're like, hey, this is a medical emergency. You should get in. I'm like, oh, I got work to do. I got stuff to do. I don't have time for this. Right. Yeah. So I'm like, all right, I better go in. So I went in and, you know, talked to the doctor and he said, hey, you know, this, don't automatically assume this is cancer. It can be a whole host of things. Mm-hmm. So we're going to, you know, get scheduled colonoscopy for it. So that was the next step. Right. So my mind was put a little bit at ease. I you know, I knew cancer was a possibility. I think you probably thought it was a probability. I think maybe that point in time I was in a little bit of denial. Yeah. Maybe hopeful that it wasn't that diagnosis.
Sure.
So I don't know how many days went by, maybe a week later, you know, you do your, they did it at the VA. So at this point in time, I'm thinking to myself, okay, the VA's been great. They've been great. I love them. But this is serious now. Should I be going to IU Health, for example, or somewhere else? But at that point in time, it was too late. Like, we were committed. And a very young doctor was doing the procedure with some guidance from a more senior doctor. So I felt good about that. So you go under, then you come out, and they don't tell you, but you can read it in the nonverbal cues, right? So even when you're under, I come out from medication, and you're still kind of under the influence, but you sober up really quick, right? You come... Yeah. It kind of sobers you up and you kind of see it in their eyes and like, well, you know, what did she say?
They found a mass.
Found a mass.
That's what they told me.
And I said, well, you know, how does it look? Well, it looks, you know, looks angry, I think is what she said. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, is it cancer? She said, well, we can't tell you that. But I could tell by the way she looked at me that it was cancer. I mean, she couldn't tell, but I knew it.
Well, you started doing this, like, well, what percentage of like, if you had to put a number.
Yeah, probability number.
What was the probability that you think it's cancer?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that was, I think, July 6th. And then I remember this because July 10th was my sister's birthday. So they called me on July 10th. And at that point in time, I knew. In fact, we, you start talking about things you can control and having agency and what can you do about it. So at that point in time, I kind of knew. And we decided we were going to go out for a cocktail and just think, contemplate life, right? So we went out for a cocktail, knew that was going to be probably our last for a while. And then they took us, called me on the 10th, on my sister's birthday. And then we kind of found out. And then, you know, you go into limbo, like, okay, what stage are you at? What does it mean? What are the steps? What are the procedures? And then you start kind of assuming, you know, worst case scenarios, best case scenarios, trying to figure out where do we go from here?
Right? Well, and it's a lot of, we kind of always joke that being in, affiliated with the Marine Corps has in many ways prepared us for this. I mean, you know, yes, in many ways, like talking about things that, you know, maybe you don't talk about every day when you're preparing for this major life thing. Mm-hmm. But also just the hurry up and wait. Mm-hmm. Like that was, we always were talking about that with the military. And with this, it's absolutely like hurry up and wait. I mean, hurry up and get to all these appointments. And now you're going to wait a week before you hear anything. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have to hurry up and do this. And then you're going to wait another week. And so it was just so much like hurry up and wait, hurry up and wait.
Yeah. But, you know, she's been fantastic, right? So, you know, so grateful to be married to this woman to my right. She's my life partner and my soulmate. And so she's been my advocate and, you know, started to kind of figure out, okay, we have to have some agency. We've got to figure out what to do. And it wasn't one of the things you want to publish, right? I didn't. So I think you talked about it earlier about not want to feel sorry for yourself, and not for a second, maybe for like a half of a heartbeat. I'm like, ah, this sucks. But then you get into, okay, what am I going to do about this? And I said to myself, I said, there's no way I'm going to feel sorry for myself when all these. I always just think about young kids and that diagnosis, and I'm like, I've had a great life. Had a wonderful life. I've done some cool things and many things that most people haven't done. I've got a wonderful wife. Children are great. Great friends. Life is good. All right. Not that I want to die, but I'm prepared to die. So we were careful about who we told people that were close to us, but there's no Facebook messages going out or anything like that.
No.
This is probably my coming out party, actually. you know, we wanted to tell people that we knew, loved, and cared for us. And, you know, so there were some, you know, obviously our friends close by who are the same friends that were mowing our lawn when I was deployed. And then, you know, our good friend Kelly, she was one of the people that I was very close with and told her. And she turned me on to a lot of things. Your organization, one. And I think she turned me on to a podcast from Lindy Thaxton, who you guys probably know.
Yeah.
And I remember dropping Kate off in Chicago for her training, her military training, having to drive up to Michigan, listening to her podcast all the way up there and listening to it all the way down Indianapolis. And so I completed, I don't know how many she had, all of them. And she went through the same thing, colorectal cancer. And, you know, so I'm just kind of preparing myself for the emotional roller coaster. And that was very, you know, it was tough to listen to because some of it was difficult for her, but it was therapeutic too, because you want to be like anything, you want to be prepared for what's to come. So I think that was very, very helpful of helping me become prepared. Right. So,
yep.
So did that. She turned me on to a book called Radical Remission, Radical Hope. And so, you know, like you were saying earlier, you don't read in college, but post-college, I love to read. So I'm like, I got to read this. Right. And that was excellent. Because it gives you what you don't want to do is give up control. And there's a lot of things that I knew inherently, but seeing them in a book, it's like, oh yeah, I'm doing this or I'm not doing that.
Sure.
One of the things that did surprise me was, you know, we did an immediate stop of, we eat pretty well, I would say, but we were, you know, tried to clean up the diet even more. But when we talked to some of the doctors that we were talking to, it almost seemed like, and this may be not for, I was surprised by this. It almost seemed like they were dismissive about the diet part of it. I was really, really surprised by that. Would you say that or no?
We were looking for guidance that mm-hmm. maybe, and their guidance was probably more along the lines of what we were already doing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, I think and when you do listen to podcasts or you read books and you read people who just like really put in some mm-hmm. dramatic measures to see the results, it's kind of like, oh, well, shoot, should we be doing more? Mm-hmm. Like, are we mm-hmm. not trying hard enough?
Right,
is it
right.
okay yeah. to have a glass of wine with dinner or, you know, to have some salami on the charcuterie board? Or should we just not do that at all?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so it,
I would
you
say
know,
yes.
But, right.
Yeah. right.
Well, and, you know, and I think when we were talking, and this was one of the things that kind of sticks with me, but when we were talking to the doctors at the VA and like, well, you know, he'd kind of like to talk to a nutritionist and they're like, oh, okay. Well, I mean, normally we don't, you know, you don't fit the parameters of someone we would have talk to a nutritionist.
Mm.
And then we were talking a little bit more and she made the comment about how some of the veterans who get care at the VA have difficulty finding access even to healthy food
okay. sure,
because of their economic situation, which just made me sad, like to think about the fact that, you know, there are people who are undergoing cancer that can't even access fresh food that could be healthy for them and their treatment.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of things we could do. So we took control to the best of our ability because you can't lose the ability to have control. And you got to have control of your medical care too. We decided very early on that we were going to be in charge of my medical care. She's a great advocate. And sometimes we're the best and the worst patients because we're informed and intelligent and, you know, some people don't like that or something.
We would kind of warn doctors when they met with us. We're like, listen, we're going to listen to what you say and follow your direction and also question everything you say. So just so you know that about us.
We got to make informed decisions. So we did. And, you know, we were hopeful. I think the initial plan was to go do chemo and radiation. And as you talked about, I was not at all excited about that, putting that poison in your body, potentially avoiding surgery. So that was the hope. It was stage 4 diagnosis, stage 3. And, so that was a hope and it was, not to get too, we talked about it was colorectal cancer, but it was actually rectal cancer. Right. So it was, you know, there is potential with surgery to lose
function.
And you know, that amongst many other things, including potentially for dying, you think about those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were hopeful that we weren't going to have to do surgery. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. So that was the plan, chemo, radiation, and surgery. So that was not awesome news, but you press on. So in parallel, I don't know where you want to jump in here. She's excellent at research, and she was just doing some.
Well, they were waiting. So they, you know, they do all these testings from the biopsy when they do the biopsy. And so he had a part of the sample was. I'm missing the word.
I know where you're at. I don't know.
Yeah. Remember. Anyway, it was basically inconclusive. Like,
yes. Okay. Yeah.
They were looking specifically for this mismatch repair deficiency.
Yeah. It's a microsatellite
instability. Yes.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, cancer treatment has protocols and they have a, you know, they're published protocols and it's literally like a workflow, if this, then that, and, you know, and that whole thing. And so a certain percentage of rectal cancers have this microsatellite instability. And if that's the case, then the treatment path diverges a bit. Because they've found that these particular types of tumors don't respond as well to chemo and radiation, but they actually respond pretty well to immunotherapy. Okay. And so that's kind of where the path diverges. And so we were waiting because we had had these inconclusive results. We were waiting to find out, you know, what that looks like. And I was on the internet, of course, shocking, right? Yeah, on the Google. And so I found a clinical trial, a clinical study that was happening at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York City. And I mean, I would like to say that this was such an amazing find that I found, but literally if you Google rectal cancer clinical study, this is what's going to come up because in the summer of 2022, when they published their first report, at that time they had 14 patients that had gone through the trial, and then there were four that were still in the middle of getting their treatments. But it is, as far as they know, the first clinical trial where 100% of the participants had a complete clinical response, which means that after they got this treatment, they were in remission, basically. The cancer was gone. And so it was, I was like, well, I think that sounds like something we should pursue.
Right.
And so I honestly had him pre-registered at Memorial Sloan Kettering before we even knew if he qualified for the study. Okay. Because it was like, well, you know, I don't want to waste any time. Like, I'm tired of the hurry up and wait. And we were waiting for test results. And then they had to have a different set of test results because it was inconclusive. So they had to do something different.
Which is super frustrating because, like you were talking about earlier, you just want to go. You want to go. Whatever the direction is, let's go. Whatever it is, let's get on it. And we couldn't.
Was that an immunotherapy clinical as well?
It is, yes. And so, you know, Mike said questioning, advocating, taking care. I think that's a big takeaway for us is just, you know, when I talked to an intake nurse, even actually from the hospital, she's like, well.
From MSK.
Yeah, from MSK. We're not sure. It doesn't look like. You know, this is it's inconclusive. And I said, well, I get that.
They told her no. They told her I didn't qualify.
I said, can you ask again? Is there someone else you can ask? And she says, well, you know what? Let me get one of the research nurses down here. And I mean, I heard back from one of the research nurses that day. And she's like, you know what? Bring him out here and we will do our own test. They have their own kind of genetic testing that. You know, I mean, most times you're sending these samples off to some lab and it's, you know, waiting in line and then weeks. And I mean,
I was going to ask, I said, this may be a dumb question, but when you hear inconclusive, then my reaction, that would be like, okay, well, let's test again.
Right.
Do you need another sample?
Right. What? Which is what they did. Okay. So they were doing, they had done kind of a basic test. And then because it had come back inconclusive, they were doing what's called a foundation test at the VA. So we were waiting for that to happen.
Sure.
And so in the meantime, Memorial Sloan Kettering was like, just come out and we'll just test him here. And if he qualifies. So, they did all of their own kind of in-house testing and they were able to run the sample and they were like, yeah, he qualifies.
So how quick were you guys in New York?
Right away.
The next day.
So I mean, was that Jenna that you talked to? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jenna's been awesome. She's the research nurse. So, you know, they flew me out. Said, let's go. And I'm like, let's give it a try. And so when you win the lottery in cancer, you're like, oh, this sucks. But like Jamie said, I mean, I think there's 45,000 people a year that get diagnosed with colorectal cancer, and about 5 to 10% of them have this repair deficiency, this
mismatch repair deficiency.
And so you're kind of like, you don't want to get your hope up, right? Because the other path was, you know, chemo, radiation, and surgery. And I'm preparing for the worst. I'm like, I'm not going to qualify for this. But you want to get your hope up. So, but then went out there, tested, and then, you know, you win the lottery and freaking getting cancer, and then you won the lottery and getting this treatment by, you know, talk about favorite sports teams. Right. Like, this is it. Like, Memorial Sloan Kettering is the A team, is the best in this country, number one and number two in cancer research. And I'm like, holy cow. This is the A team. This is the
Yankees.
The Michigan football, right? of cancer research.
I guess.
And it was in a lot of these steps, a lot of things were going on. God was at play. And there was a lot going on in our lives at the time. And when I got this diagnosis, I'm like, man, I don't know how much more I can handle. Right. This is too much. I don't know that I can handle this. Yeah. And I do think, because one of the things you want to do is increase your faith and be positive. And I do think that almost getting this diagnosis was been good for me spiritually and mentally.
Right.
For whatever reason. Oh, yeah. So anyways, we won the lottery and having this deficiency that qualified for me for the study. Went back to the VA, and the VA was great. We liked the oncologist a lot. She was excited for the prospect of, getting the treatment, right, off study, which we had the option to do. And we had a conversation outside the VA about, you know, trusting your gut, having some intuition, trusting your intuition. What should we do? And I think we really felt like being part of the study, patient number 44, once they get to 50, FDA approved, you can get it. But right now, once it's FDA approved, insurance companies will make it more likely that you can get it as a treatment.
Okay.
Right. So we thought we had a bit of a responsibility to be part of the study.
His participation in it helps make it more available, hopefully, in the future to more people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, that I'm going to touch on that real quick. So I don't want this to sound weird, but like when you were making that decision, hey, do we go into this clinical trial or not? Were you looking at it as I'm going to do it because I'm looking for hopefully a silver bullet for me, or I don't know what it's going to bring, but if it helps someone down the road, then all the better, or is it C, all the above?
It was both. I think there was, we had so much confidence in it. They've had 100%, 100%
clinical response.
Response is right. The word I'm looking for.
And you didn't want to win that lottery to be the first that.
Well, I told him, he likes to do things his own way. He's just kind of that guy. I was like, listen, for this one, you just step in line and you follow what everybody else is doing. There's no deviation here. We want this to look exactly like everyone else.
There was a good enough high probability of success to where I felt like it was a silver bullet for us, sure. But we could also help. We could have done it through the VA. It would have been a lot. It would have been way more convenient. It's inconvenient to fly. I fly to New York City once every 3 weeks. And they pay for everything. They take care of that. Sweet. So that's nice.
Awesome.
Yeah.
They pay for the travel and the study stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a minor inconvenience to make sure that we can help complete the research. So the team's been great. Andrea Sirsik, I think, is the head oncologist. She's wonderful and just a great, I got that, the A team of professionals on cancer research on this particular. And they've had 100% response. So I'm at, I've been going there since August, late August. Once every 3 weeks going, and it's crazy. It's an immunotherapy, a monoclonal
antibody.
Antibody, thank you. Yep. Dostarlimab is what it is.
Dostarlimab.
And I go in, get it through my veins. I keep working. It doesn't have any impact on me at all, neither good nor bad.
Wow.
Like I feel exactly the same.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Huge.
And so when you prepare for this diagnosis where you're going to get chemo and radiation and surgery, those are all significant impacts to your life. I almost feel like I'm cheating. I've got a really good friend who's got prostate cancer right now, and he's going through chemo, and it's not good. I don't have that same experience, right? I almost feel like I'm cheating. Now, recently, last 3 or 4 weeks, I've had a little bit of a reaction, a minor irritant rash, but in the big scheme of things, this is a side effect. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. Question: the folks who have already gone through this trial, did they just have this immunotherapy treatment and that's it? Or did they have any follow-up surgery?
Yeah, that's a good question. So part of what's kind of different about this particular treatment is that the clinical, leaders and the participants are willing to only get the immunotherapy and then see what happens.
Okay.
And so,
in
a regular course with a different kind of cancer, it might be chemo and radiation and then surgery. That's what we do.
Right.
And in this case, it's immunotherapy. And if it works, hands off, we wait and see. And so part of the study is that he'll go back every 4 months for the next 5 years. So, and they'll, just keep stuff. An eye and make sure. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. How far out are the first couple of patients in this? How far out are they?
I'm not sure when it kicked off, but I know that, I mean, I think patient number one, by the time they released the results in 2022, mm-hmm. I mean, she had been a year plus, maybe more.
So by now they're pushing that 5-year mark.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, it's been an ongoing thing. I think they're hoping that after they kind of look at this, because this is just rectal cancer right now.
Sure.
But there are other solid tumors that have this mismatch repair deficiency. Right. And so I think their next step will be looking at, you know, is
the scope.
Yeah. Is this an option for other types?
Right.
Because I think what happens a lot of times is, you know, people go through the course chemo, radiation, surgery, sometimes even chemo again after that. And then if it's not working, then the immunotherapy is something that they're trying with later stage cancer patients.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about this particular study and kind of what makes it different is the researchers wanted to look at advanced localized cases. So like stage 3, where it hasn't metastasized, it's still contained, it's advanced, but it's not spread yet. And so a lot of times I think the immunotherapy is happening later on. So they're really looking at the effectiveness of being able to
earlier.
Yeah. They call it checks the checkpoints, basically. It's a checkpoint inhibitor.
Okay.
And I think that's how they got here, right? So the immunotherapy was like the last, right? It was chemo, radiation, surgery. Last draw was immunotherapy, and it proved to be the most effective, right? So they were doing the last thing in that protocol at the last step. And that was, I think, the thesis behind this study was to flip that on its head.
Yeah.
Start that first.
So, I mean, he has had his last treatment on Valentine's Day was his last treatment. And so we go back, not next week, but the week after to do all of the tests, the PET scan and MRI and biopsy just to see if it worked.
After it's going to work. High degree of confidence that, you know, in 2 weeks' time, they're going to call it a complete. Why do I keep forgetting that word?
Clinical response.
Clinical response. Complete response.
Yeah.
After my first treatment, after the first one, the blood in my stool stopped. Jenna called me up. It's like, yeah. And it was crazy because I was there for the second time, for the second treatment. And she said, you know, do you still see blood? And I'm like, I had noticed it, but it hadn't registered. I'm like, no. She's like, oh, it's working. So it worked after the very first treatment.
Even just the pictures between like treatment 2 and 3, it was crazy. I mean, like they said, it was an angry looking thing. And it was amazing.
So you've seen steps along the way.
Yeah, 100%.
That shows that you're responding.
At the third treatment, I did a PET scan, an MRI, and it was, I think, 25% of the baseline, original baseline. So it had already shrunk 75%. So, it's incredible. I mean, there's some videos. I wish I would have sent them to you guys before. The head oncologist, I had doctor was on CNN and some really good videos, and she was basically describing how it works. And she's like, this is amazing. It's even better than we had hoped or anticipated. And the tumors are literally just vanishing. And so that's what's happening in my body. So the way it works is, you're going to have to help me out here. So with this mismatch repair deficiency, basically my immune system does not detect the cancer. Okay. And so what the immunotherapy does is allows the cancer, it's almost got like a force field around it. It takes down that force field and allows my immune system to attack the cancer. So the treatment, the drug treatment I'm taking is not treating the cancer. It's treating my immune system. It's actually, exactly. Yeah, it's amazing. And man, talk about, thank God for smart people.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, that's really cool to see that something like that work in that, you know, period.
So we were delighted when Kelly suggested, asked me if I would want to be here. And I said, well, I'm not really a podcast guy, but I don't know that I have a story to tell. But, it is, I think it's colorectal cancer awareness month. And, you know, to be here with you guys, this, you know, anticipating that we're going to be cancer free and just, like Jamie said, creating awareness. I think that's one of your pillars, right? Just early detection and getting things done. And she's right. I mean,
doing what we can to prevent, to the extent that we can. I mean, sometimes we win the lottery, like it or not.
That's right.
And then the other one would be research. I mean, look 20 years ago, this clinical trial certainly didn't help. 5 years ago, this didn't exist.
Yeah.
And the immunotherapy options wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the research. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's been amazing. And like Jamie said, being able to talk to the people that we know and care and love on. Many of my veteran friends like, Mike, I got a colonoscopy just because of you, right? So we're having an effect, right?
Yeah. Right. Yep.
Well, I think that, and I mean, talking about veterans and the incidences of cancer. Yeah. I mean, I think I've been almost 500,000 veterans, former service members, who have been diagnosed with cancer in the last two decades. And so there was important legislation that was passed in 2022, mm-hmm. which is the PACT Act. And so what that did is it greatly expanded the VA's definition of a presumptive condition. And so basically what that means is if somebody who is in service in certain locations during certain time periods and, you know, might have been exposed to Agent Orange or might have been exposed to a burn pit or might have been exposed to a uranium mine or whatever it might be, that, you know, if they were in those locations and they come upon in their health journey one of these types of diagnoses, the VA presumes that it contributed, that service contributed to that cancer diagnosis. And then that opens up a whole new arena of healthcare because a lot of those people, you know, unless you have a service-connected disability or you retire from the military, you know, VA is only your option for so long. But what this does is it provides an avenue for healthcare for these veterans who have been diagnosed with these conditions who maybe wouldn't have qualified for VA care before. So, you know, some of it is just when we're kind of thinking what do we do with this? I mean, you know, we can just go on and live our life or we can figure out what our message is. And I think that part of that is just, I mean, we have so many personal friends who are suffering from cancers that are veterans. And, you know, I think that we all know and love many veterans in our lives. And so part of it is just encouraging them to, you know, get those checkups and you know, track down any symptoms that they think are out of the normal.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah,
we appreciate
thank you.
It.
Yeah.
I'm glad things are going well. Keep us posted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have, obviously it's up to you guys. If you have photos, like a photo of here's before and here's after, I think that just to an untrained eye, I've seen this in a couple of things. Like we had, I think that same actual research project we were talking about earlier, he actually had a little video from the microscope that showed these agents attacking the cancer cell. I'm like, I don't know what I'm looking at, but he's like, here, just this, that's the cancer cell, and these things are coming in to attack it. And like literally you watch it and all of a sudden like the cancer cell just destroyed.
Yeah.
It's like, holy crap, that's
it's powerful.
Where do I sign? You know, what do you need?
Seeing is believing.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So if you guys have some of those and you're willing to show that, to do some sort of side by side before and after, that'd be really cool to put into the episode.
100%. We can do that for you.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Like I said, thank you for coming in. Thank you for sharing your story. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you guys. Really appreciate the opportunity and great work that you guys do. So keep it up.
Well, thank you.
Let us know how else we can help.
Okay. Yeah, we will. All right. And thank all you guys for joining us on this episode of the Summits Podcast. All you vets out there, thank you for your service and get checked. Know your body. All right, guys. Again, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. And don't forget, beat cancer.